WNBC and WNBC-FM, New York. It's Author Meets the Critics time. And in just a half hour, stay tuned for Every Man's Story, followed at 2:30 by an hour-long dramatization on NBC University Theater. Keep tuned for the best in radio entertainment.
Representative Saul Bloom, who is to be chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee in the 81st Congress, defends his book, The Autobiography of Saul Bloom, on The Author Meets the Critics. Here to join battle over Mr. Bloom's book are critics Judge Jeremiah T. Mahoney and Mr. O. John Ruggie. But first, meet the arbitrator of these programs, your regular chairman, John K. M. McCaffrey.
Good afternoon, everyone. You all realize that this is Children's Book Week, and so as we broadcast from the Johnny Victor Theater, we are broadcasting with a 78-year-old child as our author of the day, Congressman Saul Bloom. Now, of course, his career in business and politics is a characteristically American story. At the age of 6, he was eking out his living, running errands in a factory, and by the time he was 19, he had an income of $25,000 a year. Now, for the past quarter of a century, he has been a member of Congress and an outstanding political figure in our time. In writing this Horatio Alger story, Mr. Bloom covers a long period of history during which both he and America have come of age. But before Mr. Bloom gives you a brief idea of his adventures and experiences, let's hear a word from his critics. First, Mr. O. John Ruggie, former Assistant Attorney General and outstanding lawyer. Mr. Ruggie.
Mr. McCaffrey, ladies and gentlemen, the most fascinating part of the book to me was the many ideas that Congressman Bloom had, and most of them were good ideas, which he turned to a social service, and they were also profitable to himself. I also liked the idea of him wanting to be in business for himself, to operate on his own. I think this country needs independent businessmen, and I think one of the things that has distressed me is the gradual disappearance from the American scene of the American business, independent American businessman. However, there were certain things, and I think the congressman himself will admit this, in his early part of his business career, such things, for instance, as selling green screens as medicated or helping to collect anything but ostrich eggs to help make ostrich egg omelet at the World Columbian Exposition it was, which today would not pass better business bureau methods, and I think the congressman will be the first to admit that. I like to think that that's part of an ethics of a past stage. There was nothing serious, really, but I do think that the integrity of the business community has been growing higher and higher, and I like that. The ideas, however, in the book that I would like to see us spend most of our time on are the congressman's ideas with reference to politics and political parties. There are three propositions that he makes in the book.
All right, Mr. Ruggie, and I'm sure that we are going to get into that because I'm sure that the next critic will want to engage you on precisely that point. And our next critic is a former Olympic athlete, a Democratic candidate for mayor, a former judge of the General Sessions, and a former Supreme Court Justice, Judge Jeremiah T. Mahoney.
The autobiography of Saul Bloom is indeed a most interesting and important story in my mind. It's interesting because it reveals the tremendous struggles made by a little Polish boy coming to America 3 or 4 years of age. And the story is his adventure through America, reaching a pinnacle of highest success by becoming the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee of the United States Congress. It's a very important story, too, because it shows the youth of America, no matter what obstacles might confront them in the beginning, no matter how humble their origin might be, no matter whether poverty does beset them on all sides, no matter what the struggle in life is going to be, if they keep straight, if they continue to believe in God, if they believe in America, if they believe in America the way the founders of our country wanted the youth of America to believe in it, if they keep the faith, have courage and ambition, and are willing to work, This story shows that any young man in America can succeed.
Now, you've heard from the critics, both for and against the book, and before the author meets his critics face to face, here with a few highlights from his book, the autobiography of Sol Bloom is the author of himself, is the author himself and author of himself, as a matter of fact, Representative Sol Bloom.
Well, Mr. McCaffrey and my challengers and people who want to talk about my book, I just want to say this. In writing this book, I thought that my life would be interesting as a kid in San Francisco and what I've gone through and how I lived and how I got my start in the world and how I went to Chicago at the World's Fair and tried to do something that was never done before and get into politics, get into the music publishing business and start to write songs and then come to New York and start as a builder and a real estate man and eventually go to Washington as a member of the Congress of the United States. And in doing all of these things, I just thought I could write something that may be interesting to at least the youth of the world and give them something to look forward to. I don't look back at all in my book. I look forward, and I don't reminisce in the past. I look 100 years from now and find out what is going to happen and what could happen and what should happen at that time. Now, that's the story of my book that I can only give you in the minute that's allotted to me.
Well, now, Mr. Rogge, you've got a bone to pick with Congressman Bloom, particularly around his attitude toward political parties. You belong to different parties. It's not strange to me that you should have differences.
Well, there are three different propositions that I'd like to see us discuss. The first one, he makes at page 129, namely that if a person votes for any other than the two major parties that happen to be in existence at a particular time, he's throwing his vote away.
And what party do you belong to, Mr. Rogge?
Well, I was a registered Democrat until this year, and then thinking that the Democrats could no longer had become too much like Republicans, I joined the new Progressive Party.
I see. I understand your point of view. Now, go ahead.
Well, it's my idea that there are times when if the major parties, so-called, no longer present the issues to the American people, the people have to do something about it. And I think in this last election, the party that really brought out the issues was the Progressive Party, and they did such a good job of it that in the last weeks of the campaign, they forced President Truman to sound like a progressive himself. Now, I hope that he doesn't let the people down. I hope that he's man enough to carry out the people's mandate, which, as I see it, was a vote for a return to and an extension of the principles of Franklin Roosevelt's administration. I hope that he won't let the people down, although when I see such things as the appointment of Dulles, when I see that and this happened since the election, that they've given the roar back to the Nazis.
It happened a little bit since the writing of the book, didn't it, Mr. Rogge?
Yes, but we're discussing the proposition here as to the necessity sometimes of having...
Not yet, Mr. Bloom.
The necessity of having a new political party. And I also want to make this point. This isn't the first time that Americans, being dissatisfied with both the major parties, have tried to organize a new one. You had Jefferson and the Democrats. You had Abraham Lincoln and the Republicans. If the major parties no longer present the people with issues, they have to go out and create a party of their own. And that's what that's at least what I thought we attempted to do this year, and although we aren't going to get credit for it.
What do you think of this point of view of Mr. Rogge's?
Well, I agree with Congressman Bloom that it is best for this country that we have two strong parties. I do not like the creation and establishment of third parties. They serve no useful purpose. I have been an independent Democrat. When I do not like the things my party is doing, I fight within party ranks. I fight at the primaries, and I probably have engaged in more battles within the ranks of my own party than any living Democrat in New York. Third parties do not serve any particular purpose, except it might aid in the disintegration of the political thought of America.
Often these third parties do
give some comfort to the enemies of America. This Progressive Party this year certainly did give much comfort to the Soviets when they saw a former vice president of America, on the stump, saying nothing that America was doing was good, but everything that Russia was doing was absolutely perfect.
Mr. Ruggie.
That is what a third party might degenerate into.
I mean to say that the Progressive Party does nothing but serve the interest of Soviet Russia. That's nonsense. It was the Progressive Party, if you please, which forced the Democratic Party to look at least a little bit like the Liberal Party that it was in the days of President Roosevelt.
Right.
And as I see the role of the Progressive Party in the future, it's going to continue to be there in the first place to remind President Truman to live up to those promises of his.
The author meets the critics has had many exciting times, but we've never killed an author yet. But unless Congressman Bloom comes on at this point, he's going to explode. So
I just want to say you don't have to remind President Truman what to do. That's been his program right along, and nobody else helped him. I beg your pardon, he's done everything. The idea of the Progressive Party, you've talked about peace and security. Well, tell me any party in the world, any people that don't want peace and security.
Well, may I say something on that?
Excuse me. I won't go so far as to say that the bipartisan crowd, which I think is still in control of
both major
parties...
Well, then what are you kicking about jealous for?
I won't say that they want war. But I do say this, that their course in supporting fascism and reaction the world over, whether it's in China, whether it's in Greece, whether it's in the Middle East, and what they're doing, I mean, they've been proposing to bring Franco Spain into our Marshall Plan.
What are you kicking about Dulles?
I'm saying that's going to lead to trouble.
Well, what are you kicking about Dulles? Who brought out Dulles?
He's one of the engineers. He's, and incidentally, I may say, Congressman
Dulles. Well, all I want to say on this, that a totalitarian form of government, whether it's fascism or communism or some ism, is absolutely no good and hurts civilization.
Well, gentlemen, I'd like to deny that Truman is a fascist,
or that he is sympathetic to fascism. Well, Truman is a great patriotic American, far-sighted, liberal citizen. Courage which he demonstrated on the platform this year.
Mr. Bloom, everybody else would. The thing is that we have had discussed here so far the biographies of all three men here at the platform and several other political figures tossed in. Now, if we could get to the subject of the autobiography
of Saul. My book.
Saul Bloom.
May I ask Mr. Ruggie a question? Mr. Ruggie, will you kindly read that little paragraph in there that you referred to about my political psychology?
I had several. We've taken up the first one. The first one's on 129. Now, I'd like to go to another one.
No, wait a minute. Let's stay at 129.
All right.
That'll answer all of you.
All right,
on page 129, do you notice the word in there? I think you overlooked the effective purpose and use of it.
Yeah, well, I'll take up that very word. Well, I'll say that's the only way in which liberals could be effective in this year was to go out and bring the issues out. The Democrats wouldn't have done it. Sure, I'll take that word.
Yes.
You say if the individual voter casts his vote for either of the two, he is being effective. But if he casts it for a third party, he's not being effective.
It shows the effective preferences. Now, if you have other than two parties, and if the voter goes and votes for a party that gets a few thousand or 500,000 votes, and the other parties get 25 million, he's lost his vote. There's no question about it.
I'll take that right up there. You have the conception that if you go for any party except the major two, you're wasting your vote. Now, that's the proposition I want to challenge. I say that if the two major parties have become alike, then it's time you've got to turn someplace else. And I also say, even though the third party may have a small vote, it has yet operated to force one of the other parties to be a little bit liberal. So I say the Progressive Party forced the Democratic Party to be liberal. And I say that's all to the good, and I don't care if there are only a million votes.
I don't agree with that at all, because you're practically throwing your vote away. There's no effective use or preference
of the reasoning of the two parties. Now, the plan...
I question that.
Well,
I say that even though there was only a million votes...
I'll ask you a question.
We forced the Democrats to be liberal, and we're going to keep on trying to make the Democrats be liberal.
Judge Mahoney.
No, all right. Well,
now, I do firmly believe in the two-party system. And if you study the history of the two parties, you'll find that at one time in the history of both of them, they were more or less reactionary. Your own Democratic Party at one time, didn't you, closely to the line of liberalism, progressivism?
So you had a new party.
Years and years past.
Then you had a new party
since
formed.
Since the time of Roosevelt, of course. The proposition's been different. He is the great master of liberalism, progressivism, and the Democratic Party made no mistake unto him. But the Republican Party, the party of reaction, and I think you'll all agree with me that for generations it has been that, is now becoming a bit liberal itself.
Should I mention the fact that I'm a Republican?
For all the purposes, because it realized the people of America are liberal, progressive in thought, and now the Republicans are doing their best to get on the bandwagon. But the battle can be made within the ranks of the party, and I believe that each one's vote must be effective, and it is not effective unless it is cast.
I want to challenge the judge's statement that it has to be in one of the two other parties, and I call the attention to you, gentlemen,
in the past...
We have formed new parties. The Democrats became a new party
under
Jefferson.
Well, when did you form two parties?
Republicans became a new party under Lincoln, formed new parties.
You started in building this country under one party, didn't you? Now, then you got into all of these arguments and parties and everything else, and you had two. Now, what other way under the sun can you effectively express your opinion and will to the people unless you express it so that your vote is going to be counted?
Well, Congressman, my point was that if the two parties became as nearly alike as the Democratic and the Republican parties did, then the people have to go out and form another one. And the very fact that they went out and formed another one...
Isn't there another point?
...forced the Democrats to sound a little bit like liberals.
The people on November the 2nd didn't think that they were alike, I'll tell you that.
You're right.
I am firmly convinced that all the Mr. Rocky was for the Progressive Party, that he is now happy and much delighted over the fact that Truman has won because Truman was a great liberal.
Yeah. Well, now
Mahoney. Mr. Wallace is running almost had the effect of defeating Truman.
No, I want to challenge both those statements.
The Democrats lost New York State by a small margin. If Wallace hadn't run, New York State would have been carried by Truman. And here was Truman, the apostle of the good things in politics and American life, might have been beaten by this third party. But God intervened and he wasn't.
Mr. McCaffrey, I want to say to you, Judge, it is true that on Wednesday I was glad that it was President Truman rather than Governor Dewey.
I congratulate you.
But I want to add this.
Yeah, when are you going to
I only hope, I only hope that President Truman...
Mr. Speaker, when are you going to get back to my book?
When am I going to get back to your book?
Look, I'd like to take up another proposition in the book.
If it's in the book,
I've been talking only about a proposition in the book. You know, the next proposition I want to talk about is the one on page 130. Right? The very next page.
Does anybody wonder why it takes Congress so long to act?
I know what he's coming to.
The conception there that you have of the Democrats and the Republicans is rather that they seem to be large clubs, and the one that you belong to is the one that may be the most helpful to you. As a matter of fact, you say there that someone asked you if
you
moved to...
Please read what I say and...
All right, I'll read it just the way it
all
is.
All right, and then I won't
interrupt. Not long ago, someone asked me whether, had I moved from Chicago to Philadelphia instead of to New York, I might not now be a Republican.
Yeah.
As an abstract possibility, I must allow for it, nightmarish as the idea seems. And then in the footnote, you have this.
Yeah.
From the national point of view, the differences between the two major parties are now very slight indeed. That's the reason I say you should have a new one.
Yeah.
The real cleavages are found within the parties. To illustrate with personality, Secretary of State Marshall and Senator Arthur Vandenberg think alike. Though the former has charge of international affairs in a Democratic administration and the latter is a leading member of the Republican opposition. But do President Truman and Senator Pepper ever think alike?
That's
now, I want to challenge those propositions
Go ahead.
I'm going to challenge him, and then you can answer.
All right.
The conception that both the parties are just big clubs, and the one that you belong to happens to be the one that you joined as a result of circumstances. I say that parties should stand for principles, and that you ought to have a party in this country that represents the progressives. And if the two parties, as you say there, the differences between them are very slight indeed, then I say you yourself in your book are making an argument for us having a new party.
All right. Now, you want a new party.
Right.
Do you want the new party that you want? Do you want it headed or run by a fellow by the name of Vito Marcantonio?
Well, Vito Marcantonio in Congress? Just
yes
a minute.
No.
Just
That's
a minute.
That's the magic word. It stopped something
now
here
let's,
for about...
yes or no? Now,
just a minute. Vito Marcantonio, as I see his record in Congress, has been fighting for the people, things that the people want.
Yes.
But I also want to say this. Am I
when
wrong? Just
a
minute.
Well,
am I wrong in my understanding
that
the head
you.
Of this progressive
Why?
Party was Henry Wallace? And I want to say
behave yourself. He didn't know anything at all about
Well, now, just
Henry
a minute.
Wallace.
That's nonsense.
Henry Wallace, the head of the Progressive Party?
He is, indeed. And I want to say to you, Congressman Bloom,
that
Henry Wallace,
that
and
so.
I have come to know him,
Henry
Wallace stands for more of the things that I believe in than any other man in public life today.
And do the people...
You believe that Russia's right on everything and America's wrong?
No, certainly not, and I've never said that. He does not, and I've heard him criticize Russia. Well, the press haven't reported it.
But I have read in the press...
Well, have you read his book, Toward Peace? He criticized it. Well, you should read his book.
Public speeches.
Well, how about
Have you ever
book?
Heard one
they
of his
so
speeches?
So terribly un-American and anti-American. I
wonder how he ever could.
A man with his education and background and success in the American way of living could ever have made those speeches.
Oh, come, Judge Z.
Now,
Henry Wallace gave more expression to what the people, by and large, in this country wanted than any other single candidate. And the thing that helped elect President Truman was that in the last weeks of the campaign, he made speeches that sounded as if they could have been made by Henry Wallace. And it was the pressure of the Progressive Party that caused him to do that, and that's how he got away.
Could we get into an area which
talking,
is peculiarly,
about,
Congressman Bloom?
I want to mention my book here. I have to mention my book in a long time.
That's what I'm coming to. I'm coming to the chapters on the establishment of the United Nations, with which Congressman Bloom
I have
very
one other proposition I'd like to.
I didn't write a book on politics. I want to. This is the history of my life. I'd like to get down. You know, McCaffrey, you've got 78 years of life here. You know, and I want.
Well,
I'd like to get back
to at least
it.
10.
Well,
you've got another political proposition in this book that I think we should take up.
Well, what is it?
On page 133 here.
All right.
You say one thing was
you
very
agree
clear
with me on the others. Then
I disagree with you on both of them.
We outvoted them, Sal.
No, let's take another one on page 133 that I'm not quite as positive on the other two. I positively disagree with you on the other two. On this one, I don't know. You say on page 133 here, one thing was very clear to me. If I wanted to have a hand in politics, I couldn't be squeamish. The practical politician, like the practical voter, must make compromises.
Right.
Now, I wonder about that.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And let me tell you, you know in your experience... As a person who's dealt with the Congress and other things, you have to compromise on legislation. Can you get a bill through? Take the original bill, and I've got to give you this quick because it takes too long to explain. You take the original idea of a bill. It goes to the committee. You hold hearings. Amendments are suggested. Compromise. You go into the executive session to write up your bill. Amendments are suggested. That's compromise. You report it out. You go to the floor. Amendments are suggested. It's compromise. You go to the Senate. Amendments are suggested. Compromise. Then you go to conference. Isn't that all compromise?
Those are all compromises, yes. Congressman, and I'm not going to say that there shouldn't be certain compromises, but I'm going to put you a case in a minute.
Yeah.
I'll also admit that under certain circumstances, President Roosevelt made compromises, too. I remember one occasion when he put in as a judge in Louisiana one that a couple of the senators wanted, and I had a much better candidate. Yet those two senators voted for one of the Hull trade treaties, and the vote was 44 to 42. I was critical of President Roosevelt at the time, and yet as I look back on it, he had world problems to deal with. Yeah. But let's take another problem. I was offered this last summer a Supreme Court judgeship if I would get out of the race for surrogate. Now, do you think that I should have made a compromise like that?
Oh, well, that's a compromise against honor. That's a different thing. I would never compromise if my honor was at stake.
Honor but or if, principle, you mean?
Oh, principle. But principle. When I have... Well, that's... Judge, thank you, but I join the two. But the idea is this. If I want to get a little of something, and I can't get it all, and a little is going to help anyway, the same as you must do in legislation, the same as you must do in diplomatic matters. You can get it all because other people have got to be considered too. But
well,
I think it would be wrong.
Statement, at least,
wait,
Congressman,
wait, I think it would I'd be wrong, and I knew you wouldn't do it, Roggy, because I know you too well. You wouldn't make a compromise to take a Supreme Court judgeship to get out of an obligation that you've already committed yourself for.
And well, then we agree on this.
We agree
I'll
on
agree
everything.
With you.
There's only one
I like
wait
about
a minute.
The politics
there's...
of Bloom no. is he never compromised with honor or principle. He started out as a boy to lead a decent, clean life. He got a lot of experiences during life as a music peddler, as a music publisher, as a theatrical man, selling real estate, doing a whole lot of other things, working hard to try to make a living for himself. All of this was preparation for his great congressional record, and he certainly has made a wonderful congressional record. Just think of this little Polish boy going through all these vicissitudes of life and becoming today one of the greatest men in the Congress of the United States of America. And everybody knows that he never compromised with honor or with principle.
Now, let me tell you something, Rocky. Get back to compromise. Coolidge, President Coolidge, he wanted to send someone over to the Berne Convention in Rome in 28. Now, I'm a Democrat, and I wasn't long in Congress then, and he picked me out to send over there because he knew that no one could compromise on patents or copyright legislation, so when they kicked about, Longworth and everybody kicked about sending a Democrat over there, President Coolidge says, well, I know this, that Saul Bloom doesn't play politics. Now, I never played politics, and when I put that in the book there, I meant every word that I said. I meant every word that I said in page 128 and 129. I know my politics because I've lived with it for 65 years, and I think I do know it.
Well, I think, though, that this discussion has brought out that when you talk about making compromises, you'd concede that you don't make compromises that in any way compromise principle of any sort.
Well, I...
The compromises are in the... Sure, in the pulling and hauling of drafting legislation, you have people with different ideas, and when you come to drafting it, any piece of legislation, I suppose, is a result of a
compromise. You wouldn't have had the selective draft extension if it wasn't that I held a fella on the couch, as I say in there, when we only won by one vote, and he wanted to go in and change his vote, and I threw him on the couch and held him there. I didn't compromise with anybody. I wanted to win, and I won. That's all I was after.
You know, Saul, sometime I hope we're going to have a separate symposium when we might discuss the merits of your book. I think from what has been said thus far that you'll all realize that it is really a mighty good book. I think it is. He doesn't claim that it... I don't believe that it has any exception literary merit. But it does reveal a whole lot of...
Oh, wait,
Judge,
I do.
No, I don't...
wait,
I don't,
Judge,
I,
no.
I don't think... I don't think you do because... It's a story of a man, as he says himself, that didn't receive much school education, but he did have education throughout the world and throughout life. It's a mighty interesting book, and I recommend its reading.
I think that Judge Mahoney is quite right in pointing out that we have not given any indication of the extraordinary variety which comes into this book because of the extraordinary variety of lives which Saul Bloom has led. And it is a panorama of America from coast to coast, and you will find it has the fascination of Saul Bloom. And I'm sorry, gentlemen, the time's up for everybody. And here is Bob Sherry to tell you what lies ahead on The Author Meets the Critics.
Next week, the guest author on The Author Meets the Critics will be Benjamin Gitlow, once a pioneer organizer of the American Communist Party, and now its declared enemy. His new book, The Whole of Their Lives, presents his own story and that of his former party in terms of stubborn facts. Be sure to be with us next Sunday to hear Benjamin Gitlow meet his critics face to face. And now, back to John McCaffrey.
Before closing, I'd like to thank you, Sol Bloom, for coming here today to discuss your autobiography, and to thank you, O. John Roggie, and Jeremiah T. Mahoney, for joining us. This is John McCaffrey saying good afternoon for The Author Meets the Critics.
The Author Meets the Critics is produced by Martin Stone, directed by Lee Jones, and came to you today from the RCA Exhibition Hall in Radio City. Bob Sherry speaking. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.